All right, so back into, or not back into, I guess, into Judges. All right, into Judges chapter 1. So as I mentioned before, we have our kind of outline, the three parts. First part, prologue, where we see the crisis begins. Okay, crisis begins. And so what we're going to see in this first part of Judges is really Israel is going to fail on the both the physical and spiritual level. And that leads to a crisis where it starts the need for a king. Okay, so it creates a crisis that starts the need for a king. And so we see in chapter 1, book picks up, says after the death of Joshua. And so we're picking up again, Joshua dying. That's where the book of Joshua kind of left off on. And so we're kind of picking up where that left off. And what you see is they seem to start off pretty good, okay? If you read through the beginning of chapter 1, the people of Israel, they're inquiring of the Lord. They're talking about, like, continuing the conquest and, like, who should go up first. And do you know which tribe ends up going up first to continue the conquest? Judah, right? Makes sense. The kingly line, right? Like, the leaders. So they go first. They have some success in everything. And so this is, remember, we talked about how we had the conquest proper, and then kind of the other kind of conquest things. This is part of that other kind of conquest where they're continuing that, okay? But even though they have some success, what do we see towards the end of chapter 1? They don't complete the conquest, right? Just as we've seen before. And so they fail to drive the people out of the land. And it's interesting because even like one example is kind of interesting. It talks about in chapter 1, that the tribe of Judah actually does like conquer like Jerusalem. They capture it and all that. But then at the end of chapter 1, it talks about, and then the Jebusites like lived in Jerusalem. So it's almost as if they like conquered it and then just like left it alone. And then the people is like, all right, we'll come back in. Okay. And then like, so they're back in. And so it's kind of a weird, and that just shows like what's going on here. Not a great situation. And so again, they have failed in this of the complete conquest. They have failed to complete the conquest. They have failed to drive the people from the land. And so that part of that is what's going to lead to a crisis, as we're going to see, okay? Because again, the influence of the peoples that they leave in the land is going to be a snare to them, as we'll see in a moment, okay? And then chapter 2, you have the angel of the Lord appear to Israel, and he rebukes them for their failure to obey the Lord's instructions to, again, drive the people from the land. And as a result, what I just mentioned is confirmed that he declares that these people that they did not drive from the land will end up being a thorn in their sides, and it says, and their gods will be a snare to them. Okay, so these things are going to have a consequence for it, okay? And the people seem to be mournful about this, and they sacrifice the Lord, all that, but it seems kind of short-lived, okay? But then notice in chapter 2, verse like 8, something that's kind of interesting again. What happens in chapter 2, verse 8? Yeah, Joshua dies again. We're like, how many times does this guy die, right? So I'm going to die at the end of Joshua. Chapter 1, he dies, and then chapter 2, he dies. Okay, like this guy keeps dying. All right, so Joshua dies again. And you kind of think, well, what's going on here? Why is this, right? And it seems to be that the writer here of Judges is kind of looking at the events that happen after the death of Joshua from a couple different angles. Okay, so the first angle in chapter 1 was really focused on the people's failure to complete the conquest. Okay, it was really focused on the people's failure to complete the conquest. They did not drive the people from the land. They did not fully take the promised land. And so you can kind of say that they failed on the physical level. All right, they failed on the physical level. Chapter 2 gives us the second angle of what happened after Joshua's death. Not only did they fail on the physical level by not taking the land, but they also failed on the spiritual level by abandoning the Lord and pursuing false gods. Okay? And that's what you see more emphasized in chapter 2. And really, these two failures are not disconnected. Because if you remember, like their spiritual failure to obey and serve him alone directly links to their being unable to take the land. Because if remember when we talked about the conquest, what was their success dependent upon? Their what? Obedience. And so when they obeyed, success. When they disobeyed, failure. And so it makes sense that these are connected. Okay, and so they have not been obedient and actually have abandoned the Lord. And so again, the conquest is going to fail. Okay, they're going to fail to complete it. Okay, so that's why you have the different things recorded there. All right, and then the last half of chapter 2 and into chapter 3, we have what we're calling like the downward spiral of Israel. Okay, the downward spiral of Israel. And so throughout Judges, you have kind of what we call like the cycle of the judges. Okay, where you can kind of think, write it down. So it kind of goes around. So we have kind of what's going to happen is Israel is going to kind of give into idolatry. They're going to go after other gods and everything. Then God is going to kind of punish them. He's going to bring in a foreign nation to oppress them, punish them for that idolatry, for that sin, all that. The people will kind of cry out for help. They cry out for help. God, help us, all that. We're facing this oppression, all this. And then the Lord responds by sending a judge, okay, raises a judge who delivers the people, gets them out of that, and there's like a period of rest, okay? And then as soon as that judge dies, what does Israel do? They go back into idolatry, right? And so it's just this cycle, and it goes the same thing. They go into idolatry, God sends another nation, they cry out, God raises a judge, delivers them, they have rest, everything's good, judge dies. Oh, look, idolatry, right? Like, and it goes down, okay? So it's a cycle. But then even more so than that, it's actually like a downward spiral, okay? Because what ends up happening throughout Judges is it just gets worse, actually, as it goes along, okay? So you can almost like flip that and like make a little downward spiral there. That's really the structure of this, okay? Because you're going to see that as the book goes on, like the nation seems to get more wicked, the judges seem to get more wicked, okay? And so that's a downward spiral, okay? And even the fact that like the judges get more wicked is interesting. And that, again, teaches us an important lesson that God really uses flawed people, okay, to accomplish his purposes. He uses flawed people to accomplish his purposes, and which points to the reality that who is ultimately the true hero of all this? God, right? God is. Okay, that's what's on display. That's the reality in Judges, and that's still the reality today, right? That God still uses flawed people to accomplish his means, and it just emphasizes his glory, right? Like, and all that. All right, so that's the crisis beginning. They failed on the physical and spiritual level. They're in crisis. And so then we see part two, which is the crisis of leadership. And this is kind of the main section of the book where we see all the different judges on display here. And the main point, you can kind of consider this way, heard it described, says that God delivers his flawed people by flawed people. Okay? So God delivers his flawed people by flawed people. And then you can expand it in order to point to the need of a true king. Okay? So God delivers his flawed people by flawed people in order to point to the need of a true king. That's really the point here in this section. And so like I said, we have kind of this downward spiral happening. And so if that's the case, where do we start? At the top, so like kind of the best of the best. And then I'll go downhill from here, all right? But first off, so we have the first judge is Othniel. All right, Othniel is this first judge in chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. And doesn't this account doesn't give us a whole lot of information. It's pretty short here. But from what we have, it appears that Othniel is actually a pretty good judge. All right, pretty good judge. And it's in his kind of tenure here as judge that we have a couple exceptions to the norm of what we're going to see throughout the book of Judges. The first exception is that it appears Othniel is actually able to kind of rally a united Israel, it seems. Okay, that he's a little bit more able to rally a united Israel, which again is not the norm, as we're going to see later on. Okay, but he can lead this united Israel. Another second exception is kind of who they're fighting against. Do you catch kind of who they're fighting against here? Like in verse 8, I think in chapter 3. You don't have to say the king's name. I don't know how to pronounce that either. That's all right. That's a long name. Yeah, Mesopotamia, okay? So they're actually like a big power, okay? They're kind of a big power here, so not the normal smaller bullies like we said before. They're kind of a big bully, and so there's kind of exception there with that. But then also what's kind of interesting about his account is how straightforward it is, okay? How straightforward it is that he doesn't seem to use any like sneaky tactics or kind of shady means to accomplish his victory. Okay, the text just states, the Lord raised him up and was upon him, and he went out to war, and the Lord gave them into their hand, right? It's simple, right? It's just straight to the point, okay? And so this seems to be kind of the best example in Judges, okay? The best example of Judges. But you should also notice something about why this actually kind of makes sense, because, like, what do we know about Othniel? Do you know, who is he the nephew of? Caleb, all right, Caleb. And remember, was Caleb good or bad?
Good,
right? One of the good spies, all that. And more importantly, what was his tribe? Judah. Again, so the tribe of the kings. Okay, so this continues to set that stage that they are the true leading tribe. Okay, they're the true leading tribe. And it's going to be, again, through them that the true king eventually does come. Okay, so it's, again, setting that stage. And so Israel prevails because the Lord is with them. They have rest, it says, for 40 years. But then what? We're on our cycle of then he dies, right? The judge dies. And then we start our cycle all over, right? They depart again. Chapter 3, we come to our next judge of Ehud, all right? So chapter 3, verse 12, notice the cycle continues. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Okay, and then who does God raise up this time? To oppress them. Sorry. I should clarify what I'm saying. Yeah, Moab, okay, the Moabites. Eglon, the king of Moab. And so, again, so Israel has pursued other gods. God raises up the king of Moab to come. King of Moab also kind of brings along the Ammonites and Amalekites, and they come and take over Israel. But notice in verse 13, it seems that they're a little more concentrated. It says that they are located in the city of Palms, which is actually probably a reference to Jericho, which is kind of interesting because where did we last see kind of Jericho? Joshua. And what was happening to it? Destroyed, right? Like, and remember, even like Joshua pronounced like a curse on it. Kind of like, hey, whoever rebuilds this, they'll lose like their firstborn and their youngest son, like all that, right? It's like, well, what's kind of going on here, right? It's interesting because I was reading through some commentaries. I was curious, like, that doesn't make sense. Why is he there? And a lot of people didn't even address it. Like, that's not an issue. That seems like an issue, right? What people kind of speculated and what I found like seems kind of interesting, some archaeological kind of evidence that may back this up, that there was a structure that was found kind of in Jericho around that time that dates to this time period that would be kind of like almost like a little palace type of thing. And so very likely could have been this King Eglon's kind of little palace. It's called like the middle building. That's what they call it. I don't know why it's called the middle building, but it's the middle building if you ever want to look that up. But so it seems like the idea is that they didn't really rebuild the whole city. It was just kind of like maybe like a small outpost for Moab, or just he built this little palace for himself, a little summer palace, almost like Palm Springs. That's what I think of. I don't know if it was like that, but it's a little Palm Springs getaway. All right. And so he has that there. So that's how that kind of works of like, they didn't rebuild all of Jericho, because we'll see later on in the Old Testament, someone actually does do that. So it's not really rebuilding Jericho. It's just kind of like maybe building like a structure there or some sort of palace or outpost type of thing, right? Does that make sense? Okay. All right. So that's what's kind of going on there. So that's why the curse doesn't come upon him, all that. Okay. Okay. So back to our account. So Eglon is ruling from Jericho, and it says that Israel served him for 18 years. Okay. It's a long time. But then our cycle continues. So the people cry out to the Lord, and he raises up who? Now the good one. Who's he raise up?
Ehud.
Yeah, Ehud, right? So Ehud. And what do we know about him?
Left-handed.
Yeah, he's left-handed, right? Which, I don't know, maybe you're left-handed, you're like, finally, someone to relate to, right? Like, no, when the Bible emphasizes normally appearance, it normally doesn't, but when it does, it normally has a purpose, okay, which we'll come back to in a moment here. So keep that in your mind, left-handed, which some people think is ironic because the name Benjamin, the tribe he's from, means like right-handed, so it's weird. So the left-handed one from the right-handed tribe. So again, like, this has kind of a purpose, okay? And so if you remember, like, how this left-handedness comes into play, when he goes to bring tribute to Eglon, right, and all that, like, the people send him and everything, it seems like, what, he would have strapped his sword to probably his right side, his right thigh, to reach, like, across to bring it out. And so the idea would be the guards maybe didn't check that side because most people are right-handed, so check the other side. Oh, he doesn't have a weapon. And even King Eglon, when he's reaching for it, wouldn't have been kind of thinking, oh, he's pulling a sword out, right, kind of a thing. And so that's probably where his left-handedness comes into play, okay? But again, let's talk about the story. So Ehud is sent with tribute to Eglon, and while he's delivering this tribute, remember the story, he's going, hey, got a secret message for you, right? Like, and all that. And Eglon, what's he do? He's like, oh, awesome. Like, gets rid of all the people, right? Like, leave me alone with this guy, which, is that a smart move? Probably not, right? Like, yeah, let's just, me and him, we're good. All that. And then do you remember what happens, right? Ehud does what? Stabs him, right? Like, stabs him. What do we know about Eglon? Do you remember? Yeah, it says, the text says he's a very fat man, right? And again, when scripture brings those things up, there's kind of a purpose, okay? Not just like, oh, that's a good fact. But one of the things that's interesting is the name Eglon actually, like, in Hebrew seems to play off of the word for, like, bull or calf. And so it's almost portraying him as, like, a fattened calf, like, for the slaughter, all right? That he's been, like, fattened for the slaughter here. So Ehud stabs him in the stomach, and it says, well, like, the whole sword goes in, right? Do you remember that? Like, the fat kind of swallows up the whole sword and everything. And then the text mentions that, like, depending on your translation, like, and the dung came out or the organs came out, and you're like, oh, that's gross. Like, that's kind of gross. Like, a little graphic, yeah. And then even that gross is confirmed, right? Because you remember, like, so Ehud stabs him, kills him, right? Like, all that, and then he kind of locks the doors, leaves, and then Eglon's people are kind of, like, waiting, like, hey, what happened? Like, they checked the doors, kind of locked in. Do you remember what they assume? Yeah, he's in the bathroom. Why do you think they assume that? Yeah, because it smells bad, right? Like, probably, like, they're getting a whiff of something. They're like, oh, that's bad. And you're thinking, that's like, oh, that's gross, right? Like, that's gross. And that's kind of the point, right? The text is kind of making that point that this is disgusting. It's gross. Like, because, again, the Bible didn't have to declare all that. Normally, it just says, like, oh, and you're like, kill this guy, right? Like, and it kind of moves on, but it gives all these kind of graphic details to kind of make that point. Like, this whole thing is kind of disgusting, right? Like, and even like Ehud's accomplishing of this feat, yeah, that's great. Like, and they have rest and he's accomplishing those purposes, but he does it through kind of secrecy, through deceit, through lying, you know, like, kind of things. And so he's really just like an assassin is kind of the thing. And so the whole situation isn't like great. Okay, and so it's not as bad as it's going to get with some of these other judges, but it's still not like a great situation, right? Again, you have that standing in contrast to maybe like Othniel, where it was just very straightforward, like, yeah, we're just going to do a battle, like, God raises me up and we're done, right? Like, rather than kind of deceit and lying and all these different things, okay? So that's kind of the point with Ehud, all right? And then we have Shamgar, all right, Shamgar, at the end of chapter 3, verse 31, we have a whole one verse on this guy. So we don't have a lot of information to go on, but scholars have kind of drawn some possible conclusions here, primarily based off like his name and everything. So he's referred to as Shamgar, the son of Anath here. And so what's interesting about this is that the name Shamgar doesn't seem to be an Israelite name. Okay, it doesn't seem to be an Israelite name, but rather foreign, and some people suggest potentially like a Hurrian or a Canaanite name. And then even Anath is like a Canaanite goddess of war. So that seems interesting. And that Anath was also eventually included in the Egyptian pantheon. So again, kind of this foreign goddess is being introduced kind of here. And so you have to, again, you have to be kind of be careful with some speculations, right? Because we don't have all the clear information in scripture here. But it does seem that Shamgar was likely not even an Israelite. Okay, there wasn't even an Israelite. And this may indicate another sad reality of the state of Israel. Okay, that at that time, especially in God's like leadership, what? No Israelite would step up. And so what does God do? Well, I'll raise like a foreign guy to do it for me, right? Like, so he's going to do it. Okay, so he's going to raise this foreigner to accomplish his purposes. Okay? And in this text, who does Shamgar fight? Yeah, the Philistines. Okay, so we see them kind of coming on the scene here. And what does he use? An ox goad, right? That's like a little poking stick type of thing, right? Like, probably not your weapon of choice of to like go into battle, but it's effective because how many people does he kill?
600,
yeah. This poking stick, all right? So he uses his farm tool. But again, who's that put on display? God, right? God's on display because that's not normal. It's not like, oh, that was just a really great weapon. No, like this is God working through this, okay? So God uses him to defeat the Philistines and continue to preserve his people, okay? All right, and then in chapters 4 and 5, we have the kind of like Deborah and Barak, all right? Deborah and Barak. And so, again, cycle continues. Chapter 4 begins, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died, so continuing our cycle there. And then what foreign oppression does he raise up this time? Canaan, the Canaanites. So Jabin, the king of Canaan, and he reigned from where? Do you catch that? Yeah, Hazor. So let me give a makeshift map here, put in context. So if you think of kind of Israel, this is super accurate drawing. Okay. So you have Israel, you have, we'll say that's like the Sea of Galilee up here, you have Jordan River going down, Dead Sea down here. Over here is the Mediterranean Sea. All right. And so Hazor, right, is kind of the northern part, kind of up in here. All right. We had the, who was Shamgar going against? Philistines, they're along the coast, kind of in this area. All right, and then Ehud was who going against? Moab, right? So they are kind of like over here, and so they'd be coming from what, the east. So notice you have kind of pressure from all sides here, right? So these judges were around the same time. Some, there's some overlap also, or just even like right after each other. But what you see is Israel is kind of being squeezed from all sides, right? And we're going to see that again later on as well. Of this is, they're just from, they're taken from all different directions, okay? Like they're just getting attacked. And so this is the situation. But God, again, is going to preserve them, all right? But again, we keep this in mind because, again, none of these people are able to provide a unified front, okay? They're all just like kind of spread out dealing. And we're going to see that clearly on display here with the account of Deborah and Barak, okay? So you have now Deborah come on the scene, verse 4. In the text, kind of literally like in the Hebrew says, like now Deborah, a woman, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, all right? And so it emphasizes this, like the use of the word woman. Some people argue it's kind of more idiomatic, and so it should just be lumped in with like prophetess, which is why most translations, I think, just say prophetess. They don't include that. That's possible. But it's also possible that the writer is wanting to draw our attention to the fact that she is a woman, okay? Which, again, coming off with what we saw with Shamgar is, again, revealing another part of kind of the point here is that the men in Israel aren't stepping up, and so God's like, all right, well, I'm going to use a woman then, right? Like, this is going to happen. Like, I'm going to accomplish my purpose. And so she is judging, it says, in the territory of Ephraim, and she sends word to Barak of the tribe of Naphtali. And she says, like, the Lord's commanded you to, like, gather 10,000 people from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun. gather, it says, at Mount Tabor, and go and fight against Sisera, which is like the general of Jabin's army, the Canaanite army there. Okay? And so, notice like that the Lord instructs Barak here to also encounter Sisera by, it says like the Kishon River. Okay, it says the Kishon River. So what's interesting kind of about that is that this river runs through what we call like the Jezreel Valley. So the valley, kind of flat area, all that. So they're supposed to gather on Mount Tabor and then go down into this valley and fight this general. Okay? And you're like, okay, that's nice. But okay, why is that interesting? Verse 7, what does Sisera have with him? A lot of what?
Chariots.
Where are chariots much more useful? In a flat land of a valley or like on a mountain? Flat land of a valley, okay? And so the Lord is instructing Barak, right, of, hey, go engage in the flat area. Why? Yeah, so he gets the glory, right? So God is the one who gets the glory. It's not just like, oh, all their chariots tipped over on the mountain. Good for us, right? Like, no, it's God's working, okay? And we see that confirmed. He says what? And I will give him into your hand. I will do it, right? I am with you. I will accomplish this. It is the Lord's doing. And remember, what's their success dependent on? What do they have to do? Obedience. They have to obey. And if they obey and trust the Lord, they'll have success, okay? And so do you remember then kind of Barak's response when Deborah sends this message to him? Is he like eager? Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, he's kind of hesitant. Like, well, if you go, I'll go, right? Like kind of a thing. Again, kind of summing up the leadership at that time, right? Like, oh, if you go, I'll go, all right. So she agrees. She's like, okay, I'll go with you. And do they obey the Lord's instruction? Yeah, they do, right? They do. They gather the 10,000 men at Mount Tabor. And then verse 14 talks about how they go down from the mountain, okay, which again, they'd be going down into the valley to fight, all right? And what happens? The Lord routs Sisera and his chariots and all his troops before Israel. But then notice in verse 15 that Sisera, it says, got down from his chariot and kind of flees on foot. All right, the question is, well, why would he do that? Like, last I checked, chariots are a lot faster than running away on feet. Okay, and we get a glimpse of this in chapter 5, if you kind of flip over. Chapter 5 is this song of Deborah and Barak, and it's really kind of this like poetry kind of song about kind of what took place here, right, in this battle. And notice some kind of points here, like in verse 4, when it talks about the Lord kind of coming down and all that, and it says what? The earth trembled, the heavens dropped, and yes, the clouds dropped water. So what's probably happening? Rain, right? Rain's coming, all that. And then verse 21 talks about how it says like the torrent Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. And so this idea of this Kishon River like sweeping these people away. The Kishon River is normally like a small little brook, right? It's not like a thing that washes people away normally, right? And so the idea of probably what's happening here is what? When they engage in this battle, what? It starts pouring rain and the Kishon River probably starts overflowing, which does what to the ground? Yeah, makes it all muddy and thick, muddy, all that. Do chariots work well in that? No. And so then that's what you have, right? All these chariots just kind of get stuck, and now this army is just kind of sitting ducks for Israel, okay? So again, you see the Lord at work there. That's not any glory for the Israelites. It's like, oh, this guy's just stuck here in the mud. All right, cool. Like, I got him. All right, I can hit that target and all that, okay? But Sisera flees. That's why he's fleeing on foot. And it says he flees to the tent of Habar the Kenite, since there's peace between Jabin, the king of Canaan, and Habar. And I don't know, maybe you've heard the story. That's the whole story, right? Where you have this lady, Jael, or Yael, if you think of Hebrew, who's kind of there and she tells like Sisera, like, oh yeah, come on in, all that. And he's like, oh, can I have some water? I'm really thirsty, all that. And she's like, okay. And gives him like some nice warm milk. And you can go take a nap, right? Like, take a rest here. And you remember what she does while he's asleep? Yeah, a guy grabs a tent peg and just right through the temple, right? So, and kills him. Okay, and this kind of fulfills a little bit here of, I forgot to mention back in chapter 4, because of Barak's like hesitancy and all that to not go up and do all these things, Deborah kind of proclaimed like, hey, you're not going to get the glory for this. God's going to give the glory to a woman. And that's what we have here. This is that woman, okay, who in chapter 5, we see that kind of, she's mentioned in the song and everything as well, okay? And so again, you see, then Israel continues on to kind of Jabin at Hazor and kind of destroys them, and the Lord delivers them through that, and once again, they have rest, okay? So God using all these various means. But one last thing to point out here in chapter 5, and we'll wrap up with this actually, because I don't want to rush through Gideon. That one's pretty fun. Last thing to point out in chapter 5 is notice like in verses 14 and 15 in the song, you see like Deborah talking about all the tribes that like kind of came along. Like it says like in Ephraim and Benjamin, Zebulun, Issachar, and we know Naphtali was part of this. They were all part of this, okay? So they're gathering some people, right? They're uniting some of the tribes. But notice the last part of verse 15 into 17 where it says, here, among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Why did you sit still among the sheepfolds to hear the whistling for the flocks? Among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. And Dan, why did he stay with the ships? Asher sat still at the coast of the sea, staying by his landings. And so you have what? This kind of almost rebuking of the tribes that didn't participate. That almost they were called. They're like, hey, help us. And they said, no, we're good. We're just going to stay here and all that. And what, again, that shows what we've been saying all along, right? That there's this disunity. We saw those fracturing before, east and west at the end of Joshua. And now we see even of the tribes there, right? There's still this disunity. And these judges weren't able to do what? Unite them. They weren't able to unite the nation to kind of have this united front against these things. And so therefore you need a what? A king. You need a king. And again, not just any king, but a king who can unite the nation. Okay, that's what this is again pointing to. That's what we're trying to get at. That's what Judges is emphasizing, is you need a king who can lead, right? Who can unite the nation, who can lead. All right. And so it wraps up Deborah and Barak. And like I said, I don't want to really rush through Gideon. So we'll just kind of wrap up there for tonight. And we'll pick up next time with Gideon. All right.